Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
A big win for workers in Michigan. Prevailing wage for state construction projects is coming back. Workers at John Deere say no to a six-year contract and a strike is possible. Today on the show, courts and unions, how they often collide, and Plumbers Local 55 reaching out. Welcome to the Wednesday, October 13th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on five platforms, and that includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. When you get an opportunity, please do this. Just sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis. So many people are doing that now. We do appreciate that. And eventually give us a rating. Always a five-star rating is appreciated. Jenny Hunter is going to be our first guest on the show. She is a self-employed labor lawyer, a writer and consultant, formerly Associate General Counsel with the Service Employees International Union. She spent about 11 years with SEIU. And she's the author of a number of blogs. One of them really caught my attention, titled Justice Alito's Ties to Union Busting. What's amazing is when you become a judge, you take an oath to be fair and impartial. Two very important words. Well, over the past decade, Justice Alito has laid out a strategy for the high court to actually bust public sector unions. She writes, for almost a decade, Justice Samuel Alito has been engaged in a relentless crusade against the labor movement, especially public sector unions. He has gone well beyond ruling against unions in every opportunity. However, along the way, he has essentially instructed anti-union litigants in the kinds of legal challenges that they should bring and arguments they should make. And then, sitting on the high court, he ruled in their favor. He began his so-called side hustle, assisting the anti-union movement in 2012. The case was Knox versus SEIU. Local 1000. That's when Jenny was working at the service employees. Now, Knotts was about how public employees who were represented by but not members of a union could opt out of contributing to a particular fee assessment. None of the parties in Knox questioned the underlying rule that public employees covered by a collective bargaining agreement could be required to contribute to the costs of negotiating and administering that agreement, even if they were not full dues-paying union members. The High Court found such fair share fee systems constitutional. That was a big case, 1977, called Abood versus the Detroit Board of Education. Although none of the parties in Knox challenged Abood, in his majority opinion, Alito broadcast his desire to overrule that decision going back 40 years. He called its rationale an anomaly and a remarkable boon for unions. And that started his crusade, which led up to the Janus decision in 2018. And that's the one that dealt a huge blow to public sector unions. You got to wonder why he just didn't recuse himself. The guy from the start hates unions. So why is he assisting the anti-union movement to create anti-union decisions? And that's where Jenny comes in. There's a couple of other things she's going to get into as well. One of them is a federal judge that Biden appointed, and I don't know if this judge was confirmed, but this judge is an anti-union lawyer. Go figure. So Jenny Hunter is going to be our first guest. Doreen Cannon, who's with Plumbers Local 55, plumbers55.com, will be joining us. There's going to be a big job fair, career fair in the construction trades. That's happening tonight. Pipe Fitters Local 120, 6305 Halley Drive. Starts at 6, goes to 7:30. If you or somebody you know wants to learn about career opportunities, well, I'll tell you, there's plenty available in the trades. Bricklayers, carpenters, cement masons, electrical workers, glazers, heat and frost insulators, iron workers, laborers, painters, pipe fitters, plumbers, roofers, waterproofers, sheet metal workers. Number to call is 216-549-0099, extension 143. Mask will be required. And all those trades that I mentioned will be there. So they're going to run down all the opportunities. Again, this is earn while you learn and zero student loan debt. Zero student loan debt. Doreen is real good at these career fairs. She's been doing them for years, and they're expecting a lot of people. That's good. So she'll be our second guest. Big win for workers in Michigan. The governor there, a Democrat, Gretchen Whitmer, has announced that the state will now require contractors and subcontractors to pay prevailing wage on all state construction projects. The reinstatement a prevailing wage will ensure that qualified workers are utilized to construct and repair Michigan's physical infrastructure while allowing contractors to compete for bids fairly. That's the key word, fairly. Here's a comment from the AFL-CIO, Ron Bieber, who comes from the UAW. He said, requiring a prevailing wage to be paid in state contracting means safe, quality construction projects completed by highly skilled workers. It means working women and men getting paid a decent wage that can support a family. It means no more race to the bottom to find the cheapest labor while companies pad the bottom line. It also means a fair, competitive bidding process for contractors. All of this, said Bieber, is especially important as we look to rebuild our economy after the devastation caused by the pandemic and look to improve and modernize our infrastructure. Michigan families will be better off because of what Governor Whitmer did. And I'll tell you, the next thing they got to do is overturn right to work. You may recall previous governor Rick Snyder turn that whole state around, anti-labor. I mean, Michigan, home of the UAW, come on. But they got rid of collective bargaining, just like Walker did in Wisconsin, Scott Walker. And then they dumped prevailing wage. Now it's back. Yeah, that's one to watch, no doubt about it. John Deere workers in Iowa, Illinois, and Kansas have voted to reject a six-year contract. 90% of the members opposed the contract. 99% of voting members voted in favor of authorizing a strike last month, but the current contract was extended. The workers expressed frustration that union leaders had not called for a strike after the vote, and many heard echoes of the 1997 contract talks where they felt the union had negotiated a contract that undercut future workers. Well, the contract rejected included modest wage hikes, 3 extra holidays, and 2 weeks of parental leave. It did not resolve a central concern for workers, the pension plan. Get this, the plan would be entirely eliminated for new hires, who instead would receive 401k contributions. And the two-tier system that the 1997 contract created would remain in place. Also, full pension and health care benefits for retirees. They were going to chop at that. Well, the negotiations are occurring against a backdrop of record profits for John Deere, which raked in $5.9 billion this fiscal year, a 61% improvement on its previous annual record. Its CEO's pay increased by, and this is just during the pandemic, 160%. How would you like to make 160% more during the pandemic, which is what, 18, 19 months? Not bad, huh? Sean Fields is an assembler, and he explained that it all made his vote against the contract simple. As he put it, we got crumbs. That's all it comes down to. UAW said that it will call a strike if no agreement is reached by midnight tonight. So we might be talking about a strike at John Deere tomorrow. Following a strike, Michigan auto plant supplier ZF Marysville has agreed to recognize its employees' union formation with the UAW. ZF Marysville plant was previously jointly operated with Stellantis, and Stellantis workers had a contract. However, unionized Stellantis workers were transferred to other locations, leaving ZF to operate the plant. When ZF workers attempted to unionize, the company went back on a previous neutrality agreement. So the ZF workers then went on strike for over a week until the company yielded and agreed to recognize the UAW as the exclusive bargaining representative. The Stellantis name is the new name for Chrysler. Boy, that name has been messed with over the years. Meanwhile, a group of electrical workers organized with the IBEW protested their working conditions at a weekend trade show. This happened on Sunday in Nashville, Tennessee. The workers were protesting 7-day work weeks, 12-hour days, lack of breaks, and meager pay and conditions. The groups had members at the Spring Hill General Motors plant and was otherwise composed of people from across the country who met to protest. And one more here. Southwest Airlines has been experiencing now 5 straight days of widespread cancellations. Early numbers show 7% of Southwest flights were canceled just yesterday. Monday, 435 flights canceled. Altogether, it's well over 2,000 since last Friday. When asked by CBS News if there was any chance the disruption could have been caused by pilots calling out sick over the company's vaccine mandate, Captain Casey Murray, president of Southwest Airlines Pilot Association, said that was not the case, and that the airline's pilot sick rate for the weekend was right in line with what was occurring over the summer. Squarely on Southwest, he said, I point to how they manage the network and how their IT also supports the network. Once a little hiccup occurs due to the internal processes, our pilots are not getting to where they need to be. We've been sounding this alarm for about 4 years, and they have done very little to correct it. So there's a lot of blame going around with Southwest. Meanwhile, a lot of passengers are sitting at airports. All right, we have to take a break. When we come back, Jenny Hunter talking about the makeup of our courts and how they like to go against unions. That's coming up next.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with cancer after taking Zantac? If you have taken Zantac and have cancer, you may be entitled to compensation. The trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. Let's go to line number one. Welcome a newcomer to the show. Her name is Jenny Hunter. And Jenny is a self-employed labor writer and a consultant. Formerly, she worked with the Service Employees International Union, a associate general counsel, I might add. And she's here to talk about, there she is on line number one right
Hello,
now.
Hello, thanks very much for having me.
Hey, it's a pleasure to have you. I caught your article. We have a partnership with so many people around America. One of them is the UCOM blog. And Chris LaGrange does that, and he does it so well. And I saw your article about Justice Alito's ties to union busting, did a little more research, and I found out, you know what? This woman belongs on America's Workforce. We got to talk with her.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, yeah, really. And this was an article that you wrote for, what is it, Balls and Strikes? Talk to me about that publication.
Balls and Strikes. It's a new publication that's sponsored by Demand Justice, which is an organization that's trying to kind of call attention to the courts and the importance of the courts for progressives and the labor movement. So Balls and Strikes is, you know, the idea is that a lot of journalism that covers the Supreme Court is super respectful and hands-off and kind of doesn't tell it like it is. So this website is devoted to articles that really tell the truth about what the Supreme Court is doing and the harm that it's causing to America. So I was really excited to write this. You know, being in the labor movement and being at SEIU, I worked mostly with the public sector. So I'd had sort of a front row seat to see Justice Alito's long attack on public sector unions, but I think that story isn't quite as well known generally. So I wanted to write this article to kind of highlight it and then to ask the question, you know, he has basically, I'll say this 10-year record of not just ruling against public sector unions, but really almost coaching the groups that bring lawsuits against public sector unions, telling them what kinds of arguments they should make. And then when they do what he said, he rules for them. So it's really an improper kind of relationship. But he doesn't have to recuse himself from any of these cases involving unions. And so that's kind of the other part of my article, is why the rules about recusal are just really weak and don't do enough to keep the courts, you know, impartial.
You said that he was coaching the anti-union attorneys, and he did this coaching as a Supreme Court justice. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm not saying that he like called them up secretly or anything like that. This is all just in his opinion. So it's going back to 2012. The first of these cases was one called Knox versus SEIU Local 1000. It was really a kind of boring technical case about this local union had done a mid-year dues assessment, and the question was, did they have to give people notice and let them opt out? Nobody in the case questioned, you know, the sort of 40-year-long precedent, which says that public employees who are not members of a union can still be required to contribute their fair share of the cost of collective bargaining. You know, there's fair share rules in, or there were fair share rules in many states. They had been there for a long time. The Supreme Court had upheld that kind of arrangement in the 1970s in a case called Abood. So nobody had questioned that underlying, you know, background. But in the Knox decision, Justice Alito wrote this opinion where he just kind of attacked Abood, even though that none of the briefs or the discussion in the case had been about that. He called it a remarkable boon for unions and wrote that it approaches, if it doesn't cross, the limit of what the First Amendment can tolerate. So he was basically advertising his desire to be able to overturn this precedent. Mm. And Justice Sotomayor wrote a dissent where, or wrote a concurrence where she said, this is just improper. We're not supposed to go out looking for cases. We're supposed to just rule on the cases before us. You're basically strongly hinting that you want to overrule this precedent. That's not how we're supposed to behave. But it worked. After that decision, you know, there's this network of anti-union groups that are all funded by sort of dark money, sometimes corporations or foundations. And so a whole bunch of groups started bringing all these challenges to public sector unions and saying that arrangements where they could charge fair share fees were unconstitutional. So a couple years later, one of those cases got to the Supreme Court, Harris versus Quinn. That one was the National Right to Work Legal Foundation brought that case. And at the beginning of the case, they hadn't challenged Abood. But after Justice Alito's opinion in Knox, they kind of switched up their arguments and said, you know, you should overrule Abood. And so in that case, in the oral argument, Justice Alito really went out of his way to show how much he does not like unions. He said something to the effect that the real reason that these that case was about home care workers in Illinois. And he said the reason home care workers even had collective bargaining rights was because Governor Blagojevich had gotten a campaign contribution from the unions. And then once he'd gotten elected, he had signed this executive order to give collective bargaining rights, really suggesting that this was like a corrupt arrangement, which was totally baseless. So anyway, when the Harris decision came out, it didn't actually overturn Abood, but it was just, again, filled with attacks on that decision. Justice Alito's opinion narrowed Abood by saying it didn't apply to home care workers. They couldn't have arrangements where they had fair share fees because they weren't full public employees. So so that, again, just kind of encouraged all these groups to continue bringing more and more cases. And then the next case, actually, this is really an amazing fact pattern that this organization, the Center for Individual Rights, brought a case called Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. And they wanted to get to the Supreme Court as fast as they could, so much that they actually asked the lower courts to rule against them as quickly as possible. That's not something that usually you do in court.
That's ridiculous. Oh, my.
Yeah. No, they filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings against themselves. It was, I remember everyone was trying to research, can you even do that? Like, no, you don't do that. So it kind of worked as they got to the Supreme Court pretty quickly, but they did so just after Justice Scalia died in 2016. And so then the outcome in that case was a 4-4 tie. So this is one of the times where that nomination to the seat that had been Justice Scalia's was so important and really, you know, determined the outcome of this line of cases and what was going to happen to the public sector labor movement. Mm-hmm. So as everybody knows, you know, President Obama nominated Merrick Garland to that seat, but the Senate Republicans didn't allow a vote. And so then after Trump was elected, he nominated Gorsuch instead. So that's how that went. And then in 2018, Justice Alito kind of finally finished this years-long attack on the public sector unions, and he overruled the Abood case in Janus versus AFSCME. So the upshot of that case now is that public sector unions still have an obligation to represent all the workers in their bargaining units, but any of those workers can opt out of paying anything for that representation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's very harmful. So far, unions have really done an awesome job of organizing and explaining to members why it's important that they become members and pay dues so that the union, you know, still has the resources it needs to fight for the workers, but it is a real struggle, and it is harmful to the labor movement.
So, Jenny, basically the 10-year campaign to bust unions was successful on behalf of Justice Alito. I have to ask you this, and I work in the court system. I work as a public information officer in the Cleveland Municipal Court. I mean, far cry from what we're talking about here. We're talking high-level courts. But there's two words that are very important when it comes to judicial matters: fair and impartial. And I'm sure you've heard that many, many times, fair and impartial. I have to ask, how did Alito get to where he is today? I mean, some of this should have come out. I mean, this guy is clearly against unions. I don't understand where this all fits together. Can you help me out on that one?
Yeah, I mean, it's not an accident. I don't know why Justice Alito himself is so anti-union, but it's part of the Republican and the sort of corporate policy goals in this country is to weaken the labor movement. And, you know, when Justice Alito started this kind of campaign, it was in 2012. It was right after all the attacks on unions from Governor Scott Walker and other state elected officials. I think it really was a realization that the public sector had become the majority of the labor movement and was, you know, the remaining strongest part of that movement. Republicans saw that it made sense to attack unions. And unfortunately, a lot of the justices on the Supreme Court basically enact Republican policies through their judicial decisions. That's not what they should be doing, but that's what they do. So that's what happened here. And in a lot of cases, I don't actually remember if Justice Alito himself had a long record of being anti-union when he was a lower court judge. But many of the justices actually have these kind of anti-worker records, and I think it helps them to get nominated to the Supreme Court. So it's really not good.
No, it's not. And it's not good at all. You know what? I got to take a quick break. Can you stay with us for another segment here?
Yes. Thanks so much.
Because there's more. Jenny Hunter joining us on our live line. She's a self-employed labor lawyer. She worked with SEIU as a associate general counsel for about 11 years. We'll continue our conversation with her. Doreen Cannon, on behalf of Plumbers Local 55, will be joining us later in the show to talk about a career fair in the construction trades. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Buildings, bridges, skyscrapers, and more. Structures that are the face of our cities and towns were built by members of the Iron Workers Union. That's why it's important that our workforce of over 130,000 iron workers continues to be the safest and best trained in the field. With 154 training centers, we invest over $90 million annually in safety and training. We're growing the next generation of union iron workers. There are so many reasons to put your trust in our iron workers and their employers. Learn more about us at ironworkers.org.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialists, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
Mesothelioma is a rare type of cancer caused by exposure to asbestos. If you were exposed to asbestos and have mesothelioma or lung cancer, the trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on 5 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Area Labor Federation, all connected to the AFL-CIO. Let's go back to our live line, rejoin Jenny Hunter. Jenny was a former associate general counsel with SEIU, 11 years there. She's a author of several blogs. We're talking about judges in very high places that have anti-union records. Not good. Just want to talk a little bit about your background. I take it you know Amanda Jarrett, because we had Amanda on the show for a couple of months talking about labor law. Did you work with her at the SEIU?
I didn't work with her, but I do know her. Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, yeah. She's now on the NLRB. Good to have people like her in especially dealing with the National Labor Relations Board, which was so anti-union during the Trump years. But you're back. What made you get involved in unions and lawyering? I forgot to ask you that at the beginning of the show.
Oh, good question. Well, I went to law school. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, honestly. I went to law school when I was pretty young, and I didn't have a real background in unions. But actually, when I was in law school, I went to Yale. The unions of the workers at Yale went on strike, and I helped to organize to try to keep the law students from crossing their picket lines. It just seems so obvious to me that here's this incredibly wealthy institution that we're all going to benefit from its reputation for the rest of our careers. And there's all these people who are working to keep it running every day, who are underpaid, and it was just really unjust. But to my surprise, it seemed not to be obvious to everybody, all the students, that, you know, they should respect the picket line. People were sort of, not all of them, but some people were just felt like it was an inconvenience. And so that made me think a lot more about the labor movement, and I guess eventually I decided to go work for a labor law firm and then for SEIU. I really miss being part of the union. I love the labor movement.
Yeah, SEIU's done some incredible work over the years, so that's good. I always ask people how they got involved, and obviously you saw some injustice in the field and you decided to correct it, which is good. We're talking about Justice Alito's ties to union busting, and this article is on a publication. If you Google balls and strikes, you can find how a Supreme Court justice, one of nine, actually coached anti-union litigants over the years, and this led up to the Janus decision. It was a crusade. It really was a crusade. You point out in your article that all federal judges are supposed to recuse themselves to take, as you write, no part in the consideration of a case in matters in which their impartiality might reasonably be questioned. That being said, why didn't he just step aside on this whole thing? Any grounds for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very good question. The reason, there's two reasons, really. One is, in 1994, the Supreme Court decided that this standard about your impartiality might reasonably be questioned. They sort of made this huge loophole in it for anything that judges say in court or in their judicial opinions can't be used as evidence that they are partial or biased. So that's obviously like a tremendous hole in this rule, because if a judge spends all their time writing decisions that show their bias against one party or one movement or group, that is not enough reason for them to have to recuse themselves. So that's the main thing. The other reason is that actually the Supreme Court justices, there's nobody who can tell them when they have to recuse themselves. They just make the decision entirely on their own. You can't appeal their decision to anyone. So even if that rule were stronger, Justice Alito could just choose whether he wanted to pay attention to it or not.
That's why they are supreme, I guess. Wow. Wow. That's powerful. I want to switch gears here for a little bit because, obviously we have a pro-union president in place, and you wrote a piece about a federal judge that was, Christine O'Hearn? And maybe you can refresh me on here. Did she get appointed? What's the story on her?
Yeah, I think she has been confirmed. She had her hearing back in June with the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I watched it because it was as you said, President Biden, you know, has said he wants to be the most pro-union president in history. In a lot of ways, I think he has been. But he obviously has realizes the importance of judicial nominations, which is great. But in this case, he nominated this attorney, Christine O'Hearn, whose background is in management side labor and employment law. So she spent decades representing employers against workers' claims of discrimination and harassment, and doing, you know, what her firm calls union avoidance, which we would call union busting. So, and the two senators from New Jersey are Democrats, and they recommended her. As far as we know, that's how this usually happens for lower court judges. She was nominated to the District of New Jersey. Usually the senators give names to the White House, and the White House pretty much appoints who they ask. And what was really surprising was when Senators Menendez and Booker from New Jersey put out a statement in support of her nomination, they described her as being a champion for women and for workers' rights. And I was just super confused about that. I don't know whether they just misunderstood what her record was, or she did have a few cases where she represented individuals. Maybe they were sort of thinking that those were more representative of her career than they actually were, or they just kind of thought they were saying nice things and it didn't really matter. Anyway, her hearing, no one asked her about her background. It was just, you know, she's qualified in the sense of she has a law degree and has practiced for a long time and gotten some accolades. So she's kind of a traditional judicial nominee in that way. She probably has connections in the legal world of New Jersey and is well regarded in general. Mm-hmm. But I wrote this to highlight that President Biden really should be nominating labor lawyers. And he has since then, I'm really happy to say, especially Jennifer Sung, who is, I think, about to be confirmed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, has a great background as a labor lawyer. And I hope that we'll see more of nominees of that kind appointed to the bench.
Do you feel that perhaps the Biden administration just overlooked this, or they just took the senator's words for granted here?
I think they probably just took the senator's recommendation. I mean, it's the problem with judicial nominations is that the Republican Party has focused so hard on this for so many years. You know, all of President Trump's nominees were pro-corporate, had the backing of the right-wing groups like the Federalist Society. There wasn't like a few labor lawyers who snuck in there or anything like that. Uh-huh. But on the Democratic side, at least in the lower courts, the system still seems to be that senators often have these committees, which are made up of, in some cases, just well-connected lawyers in the state, often corporate lawyers or prosecutors. And they kind of vet names, so they often end up recommending people who they know or who are like themselves. And so if the senators just take those recommendations and then hand them off to the White House and the White House rubber stamps it, then you just get kind of perpetuation of people who are, they're, you know, perfectly reasonable lawyers, but they tend to be corporate lawyers, prosecutors. You don't get the kind of background of people having represented workers or poor people or doing civil rights law, which is what we really, really need on the federal courts to balance them out after the years of being packed with right-wing judges.
Jenny, I sense the term follow the money here. Probably yes. these corporate law firms are spending a lot of their campaign dollars on making sure that certain people get these appointments, and more often than not, they get confirmed too. And this is a really good case of that.
Yeah.
Wow. Jenny, we have time for one more here, and that is the blog Labor and COVID-19, A Long and Short Attack on Progressive Collective Action. You point out, and this was done several months back in February, you point out how the pandemic, when it started, I mean, we saw a lot of activism that seemed to have died down a little bit. Now, I know there's a lot of strikes going on right now. There's a lot of people that are refusing to work, especially in like hospitality jobs and all that. Mm-hmm. But can you reference what you see happening here?
Yeah, I mean, when I wrote this, like you said, it was in February, and I was seeing the change that had happened over the last year up till that point. You know, from the early pandemic, there was this feeling of solidarity among Americans, like, although we're all in this together, yard signs and the public applause for essential workers. And by early this year, it felt like that had disappeared, and that's even more stark now. There have been these concerted attacks on the idea of people wearing masks or getting vaccines in order to protect others. And I saw a parallel between that line of attack and the way that the right wing attacks the labor movement. I think it's an attack on the idea of collective action and the idea of people coming together to improve things for their communities. So, you know, in the parallel that I drew in this article was to say that after the Great Depression, there was kind of at least some agreement that collective action was necessary, and Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act to let workers collectively bargain. But then there was a huge pushback against that. People, the right wing, sort of framed unions and collective action as un-American.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the attacks on pandemic safety precautions kind of follow the same path. Like, at first, the pandemic shocked everyone into realizing, okay, we need to stay home, we need to wear masks, and this kind of thing. But then there was a big backlash, and now people, you know, describe their neighbors as like sheep if they wear a mask in the grocery store. And I think it's kind of part of a larger problem where the right wing really does see that collective action is powerful and harmful to them. And so they attack it in all sorts of ways by criminalizing protests, making it illegal to bring water to somebody who's waiting in line to vote,
right,
attacking unions. And I think it's really harmful to society, and that elected officials on the other side need to make it a priority to encourage and just like sing the praises of the power of people working collectively to improve their communities.
Yeah, for the life of me, I can't understand how these attacks over safety are still going on. I mean, we're trying to be safe in America. That's what this is all about. But there's a group of people, and a large group of people, that don't want that to happen. That's the sad part. Jenny, we're just about out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today. Jenny Hunter, who is now a self-employed labor lawyer, spent 11 years with the SEIU. Do you have your own website yet, or what's the story on
that?
Oh,
I probably should, but not really. I am on Twitter, Jenny Hunter DC.
Okay, would you give me that one more time?
Yes, on Twitter, I am at Jenny Hunter DC, all one word.
Jenny Hunter DC. Well, there's a lot of folks that follow Twitter, so I'm sure you'll get a pickup on that one. Hey, we appreciate your time. We certainly appreciate what you're saying and doing. So let's keep in touch on issues like this, okay?
Well, thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
You got it. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Doreen Cannon with Plumbers Local 5 talking about careers in the trades.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferentz with America's Workforce.
And, of course, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to line number two. And welcome back to the show. It's been a while since we had Doreen Cannon on. Doreen is president of Plumbers Local 55 in Cleveland, Ohio. What is it, 12 years now as president, Doreen? Is that right?
Yes, 12 years.
12 years. How did you get involved in plumbing? Let's start right there. I know you want to talk about this career fair tonight, but I always ask many of my guests, okay, you got into this line of work. What made you decide to get in that line of work? Go ahead.
Well, it's funny. I worked retail for years. I was in retail management, working a lot of hours, working on salary, you know, not getting paid for all the hours I was working. Then I was lucky enough to be able to stay home and raise our son. So when I was ready to go back into the workforce, I said, you know, I'm going to do something I always wanted to do. I always, I'm the youngest of three daughters, so I was kind of like the boy my dad didn't have, and he used to take me and putz around with me. I was always helping him fix things around the house. So I saw a career fair, exactly like we have going on this evening, in the paper. And I went to that, and that's where I started researching all the different trades, and I really liked the plumbers and the education they had to offer. And so I applied to the apprenticeship, and the rest is history, as they say.
That's awesome. So what did your dad say when you told him that you were going to go into plumbing?
Well, it actually was my mom that saw the little article in the paper about the career fair and yeah. called me up and said, hey, you know, you have to go to this. So my dad was a pipe fitter by trade, but he was in the aerospace union. He actually worked in-house at a manufacturer's, TRW and Union Carbide is the two places that he worked. So he, was in the trade himself. So he said, well, you know, why don't you try plumbing? That sounds like a good line of, you know, a trade to go into. So he was thrilled. I mean, he loved once I got in the apprenticeship program, I would talk to him almost every night saying, wow, this is what I did today. This is what we learned in school. So he loved it.
Oh, that's cool. And ironically, the apprenticeship fair tonight is at a Pipe Fitters Union Hall, Local 120.
That's correct.
That's great. And it's located at 6305 Halley Drive. Starts at 6 o'clock, goes to 7:30. Now, you've done many of these. I'm hearing so much that there's a need for people in the trades. I'd like to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, so we're coming up on the next few years where the last of the baby boomers are retiring. So that's creating a big void in these trades. So this is a great time to try to get in, and there's a lot of opportunity in, and we need to fill those trade people in these apprenticeship programs and kind of take up the slack for the big retiring group that we have coming up.
As far as the retirements, is it across the board? I'm looking at bricklayers, carpenters, cement masons. You got electrical workers, glazers, plumbers, pipe fitters, painters. I mean, is there a shortage in all those? I mean, are retirements expected in all those respective
yes.
trades?
Yeah, at this time right now, all the trades are, you know, looking for more people to apply and more people to get in. So I definitely would say it's across the board. And we've been lucky because the Cleveland area has been very busy. So we've had good employment down a little bit during the pandemic. But we've definitely, you know, there's a lot going on in Cleveland right now. And we need the tradespeople to help build these buildings.
Doreen, talk to me about women of color. I know the trades over the years have reached out because it's often been said getting involved in the trades, and you know this all too well, is a pathway to the middle class. And there's a lot of people that are, I mean, they're minimum wage. They're working maybe at an Amazon place. I mean, they're going to make anywhere. In some cases, I know Amazon is raising their wages, but it doesn't even come close to what you can make in the trade. So how's that going for you?
It's going well. I mean, I think even across the board, it's people are starting to talk more and more about the trades and realize that this is a great option for someone who's not interested in going to college. And we are even seeing where we are getting people who have 1 or 2 years of college now applying to get in the trades because they realize that's really not the, you know, the direction they want to go. Maybe college just wasn't for them, or they see, hey, I can't afford to have these loans hanging over my head for the next year. So this is a great option that kind of takes away that, you know, it's an earn while you learn type of program. There's no student debt for you. But women, slowly, I think the challenge for us and what the Cleveland Building Trades Tradeswomen Committee tries to do is get the information out there that these are really good trades for women to get into. And a lot of women don't even realize that these kind of programs exist. So the more we get the word out there, the more people we can get to attend these apprenticeship fairs, the more minorities and women we are seeing starting to apply to these programs.
Doreen, let me ask you, are we making a dent in the numbers? I know nationally, as far as women in the trades, it was for many years like 2 or 3%. Where do you see that now? And maybe you can speak to the local area here. That's the area that you cover. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's still right around that 3% here and nationally. But I think it really is growing. Certain parts of the country have a high percentage. There are parts of the country that are 8 and 9% females. And part of that comes from jobs in the area that have a requirement for minorities, females, residential, you know, people from the residential area that the place is being built. So certain parts of the country have even a stronger presence. And those are parts of the country that have really large tradeswomen organizations that are nonprofits that are in those areas, so they have the ability to do a lot more outreach. And that's what we're trying to work towards here by building up the Tradeswomen Committee. That's what the point we're trying to hit, where we really can make a big impact in the community.
Once again, we're speaking with Doreen Cannon of Plumbers Local 55. There is an apprenticeship fair happening tonight, Pipefitters Local 120. That's 6305 Halley Drive, Cleveland, Ohio. Starts at 6, goes to 7:30. For more information, you can call this number, 216-459-0099, extension 143. Need to point out that masks will be required, okay? Now, other than that, what's the best way, those listening right now, how do they come prepared for this? I'm sure you're going to, you know,
really
bombard them with a bunch of information, but talk to me about that part.
So be prepared. You know, you don't really have to bring anything. Just be prepared to have maybe a list of questions you want to ask. Don't be afraid to ask, you know, what is the starting wage of your apprenticeship program? How long is your apprenticeship program? When do you go to school? You know, what exactly does your trade do? Because a lot of people don't realize that, you know, like the plumbers also do all the medical gas in the hospital. So a lot of people don't realize what a particular trade does. And that's why this is the perfect place to find out all that information, and one of the few places where you can come and talk to all the trades at the same time. It's kind of a one-stop shop, right? You can come and, you know, hit up all the trades at one time. So it's a great opportunity, a great informational session, and I really encourage anyone who has any interest at all in any of the trades and these amazing apprenticeship programs that they offer to come tonight and stop in and get some information.
And I'm reading you have 17 trades that will be there tonight. Is that right?
Yes, yes.
Very good. Okay, again, mask will be required. Starts at 6, goes to 7:30. Any idea what kind of crowd we're expecting tonight, Doreen?
Well, because of COVID, we haven't had one for over almost a year and a half now. But the last time we had one, there was over 350 people who came.
Whoa. Okay, real good.
Yeah.
Well, you take care. I know you got a lot of work to prepare for this. Again, Doreen Cannon, president of Local 55 of the Plumbers. Again, that number, 216-459-0099, extension 143. Thank you for joining us on the show today, and keep in touch on future apprenticeship fairs, okay, Doreen?
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, latest from the UAW and IATSE Local 6. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.